Blog Talk Radio.
Ready? Welcome to Booker T. Washington Speaks on this Saturday evening, May the 20th, 2017. This evening we are going to discuss a very critical topic that is affecting or will affect all African Americans, and it is something that we need to all think about and plan for, and that is the educational cuts that the new president, President Donald Trump, has announced in his pending budget that he plans to present to Congress to make. And this is supposed to be something that he believes is going to be beneficial to our country. I suppose he thinks that he will benefit our country by saving money by doing these cuts. But we are going to suffer, and most Americans will suffer. I want to share something from the Washington Post that actually gives more details about the cuts. the first thing that we know is that he is going to cut out one of the loan programs that many African-American students depend on, that helps many African-American students go to college. And this is the Perkins Loan Program. And there are others, there are other things that we have heard that he plans to cut. But the fact is that anything that he does cut, that African-Americans have been depending upon, will certainly have an effect on us. And there's another program that he has indicated that he wants to cut, and that is the Student Loan Forgiveness Program. Now, this program allows a complete forgiveness of student loans based on students who have graduated working in social welfare type of jobs after they have graduated. And for each year that they work in a social welfare type of job, including teaching in rural communities or doing social service type jobs in rural communities, they will have their loans forgiven. Other things that he has indicated that he wants to cut are monies that go directly to colleges from the federal government to help the colleges to be able to build additional classroom buildings and to set up additional programs. So the Washington Post has a more extensive article, and we'll be discussing it as we continue in the show. We are waiting for additional callers to come on, and so when we have additional callers, we'll discuss some of these things. But the main point is that here we have an administration that has promised that it will do strategic and drastic cutting wherever possible in order to balance the federal budget, which, of course, as many of us know, is greatly out of kilter. The United States is in debt to other nations of the world by trillions of dollars. And as any of us know, that when a family or government cannot keep its balanced budget at some point or another, it's likely to become bankrupt because it won't be able to pay its bills. The income that it takes in will not be sufficient for it to be able to basically operate any longer. And consequently, we are going to be facing a situation where we'll be seeing our country default on loans that it has taken out by selling bonds, treasury bonds, and other bonds, which are basically IOUs to other nations. And when we can't meet the payments, they have the legal right to claim assets of ours. And of course, that's going to be a very bad situation to have our credit throughout the world damaged because we haven't been able to keep up the payments on even the interest on these extensive loans that we've taken out over the last 30 or 40 years. Someone may ask, well, how is that affecting black people in our education? Well, the simple answer is that if the budget is going to be cut and he plans to cut in those areas that affect education and other social services, things like Medicaid. He's promised not to cut Medicare or Social Security, but Medicaid is one of those areas that serves poor people, poor black people, as well as education. Then we are going to suffer. So it's very important that we look at this and we begin to think in terms of how we're going to deal with the situation. So we just want to have a conversation about that. We're waiting for other callers. So in the meantime, we just want you to call in to our guest call-in number. If you are listening via the internet, the number is... What you do? Okay, just call in to 657-383-0671. Call in to 657-383-0671. Now, there are many things that we can do about this. Of course, we can continue to complain about that we are not being treated fairly, but that complaining mode is not really going to solve problems for us today. It worked back in the 1950s. When we complained to the federal government, we complained to the Supreme Court that it wasn't fair for us to be put into segregated schools where our schools were only getting a fraction of the money for education from the states that white students, white schools were getting, that our equipment that our students had to use was substandard or antiquated, that our textbooks were hand-me-down textbooks that were given to the black students after the white students had used them for several years. And so we basically had a right to complain because we were being treated unfairly. And then, of course, during the 60s, we complained because we weren't being allowed to vote in national elections in some cases, and certainly in state and municipal elections. I remember as a young person when my hometown, which had a lot of educated people because we had the Tuskegee Institute College there with many PhDs and people with graduate degrees and bachelor's degrees. And then we had the Veterans Administration Hospital, which had medical doctors and nurses and people with master's degrees in other fields and social work and physical rehabilitation and other fields, that we were denied the vote. We were not able to vote in the city elections because the powers in the white establishment saw that we had the numbers that would allow us to gain control of the city government. And so they went to the state legislature and had a law passed that basically redrew the city limits so that those neighborhoods that included the most likely people to vote, the educated people, were excluded from the city. We took that case to the Supreme Court, and we complained about it, and we won. And, of course, then there were other things that we had a right to complain about, and we were able to get the courts to be eventually on our side. But this case that we're talking about tonight, for those of you who have just joined, is a little bit deeper than something we can complain about, because the way that this issue is being presented is that the people that are running the Department of Education that have the backing of the president, they're saying that neighborhoods should be able to set up schools based on the needs of the people in their neighborhoods or the desires of people in their neighborhoods and get money from the federal government. Now, I'll give you an example of what the possible effect of that could be. Let's say, for an example, there's a lily white neighborhood, and they don't want to have anything at all taught about the mistreatment of black people or even the enslavement of black people taught in their school curriculum. Under this new proposed charter school or voucher supported private school agenda, they would not be required to teach anybody anything that the families of these students did not want them to learn. And frankly, a lot of these families don't need for their students, their children, to learn anything that has anything to do with anyone other than white people, especially not about enslaving black people. So just to kind of give you a little highlight, we're going to be talking tonight about what can African Americans do to deal with the decreasing support for education for our children and even the cutting of programs that help our students, like the Perkins Loan Program and colleges and other programs to give money to the historically black colleges. So I see we do have a caller from the 757 area code. The last two digits of the phone number are 88. I hope you have been able to get the gist of what our topic is tonight. We did announce it on our Facebook page. Would you like to come on? If you like, you can announce yourself. If you want to remain anonymous, you can do that as well. But we'd like to let us hear how you feel. Okay, I see that the caller was on for a minute and they did just drop off. So we right now have lost them temporarily. Hopefully they will come back. But we're going to just go ahead and continue until we get additional callers. What we would like to also mention is the fact that we are living in a time in the history of America where America is going through what is called a sea change, S-E-A, sea change. I'm a retired Navy man, and so I'm very familiar with the reality of a sea change, and what that means is simply this. You could start off in the morning aboard ship and go out to sea, and the sea could be very calm. The sky could be clear, maybe no clouds in sight, and you could be moving along with no worries in sight. And then all of a sudden, you see clouds begin to come up on the sky, and you see the waves begin to get a little more choppy. And then in the distance at the horizon, you see really darkness, which indicates heavy rain. And the next thing that you know, you're in the middle of a storm, typhoon or a hurricane, and then you have experienced a sea change. Everything has become dangerous all of a sudden. This is that America is in the midst of a sea change right now, because what is happening is that for several reasons, we won't go into all of the details, but we can actually go back to the Vietnam War. Back in the 1960s, the United States government decided that it wanted to stop the movement of communism, a political ideology backed by military power in the Far East. They saw that the Chinese and the North Koreans had a design on the country called Vietnam, as well as the countries called Cambodia and Thailand and Laos. And so the American government felt that because of the wealth and natural resources over there that our government wanted to have ready access to, such things as oil and rubber, that the American government was going to try to stop the movement of communism because the communists were either not going to let us have ready access to these things or maybe no access at all, whereas the governments that had previously been put in place after the Second World War were friendly to the West. We put puppet leaders in charge of those countries, the British government as well as the American and French governments collaborated to support leaders that basically were puppets of these nations. And the people, the native people of these countries, the common people, were oppressed to a great extent, were actually treated like slaves of these imperialistic nations, and they eventually rebelled. And so in order to quell the rebellion, first France sent armies over there to try to quell the people of Vietnam. And when they were defeated by the Vietnamese rebels, then the Viet Minh, which was the name of the rebellion of the army in Vietnam that fought against the French under Ho Chi Minh, then they left in well, disgrace really, but they were whipped and they left. And then the United States decided to go into Vietnam and take over the job of trying to keep those people under the what we would say domination of the West. And so we sent hundreds of thousands of people to fight the Vietnamese people in order to maintain power. And we lost that war because the desire of the people for freedom was greater than our ability to suppress them. Even though we lost over 50,000 people and many billions of dollars of equipment, we had to leave. And so we never recovered that money. And the funding for that war was basically based on loans that we took out to support that venture. And we've never recovered from that. We have never been able to get that money back. And then, of course, we decided to go into the Middle East in the last 20 years. Actually, around 1990, we decided to go into the Middle East. And, of course, ostensibly, we were working to defeat Saddam Hussein, but he had been our ally. We had trained his air force and his army, and his armed forces were actually part of an international coalition that we had built up. And part of the reason why we did it was after the Iranian Revolution in the late 1970s, we felt threatened, or our interests, I should say, felt threatened by the Islamic Republic of Iran. And Saddam Hussein had established himself as an ally on our side to Iran. And the Iraqis and Iranians fought a very bloody war for 8 years. And we supported Iraq. And so we became an ally of Saddam Hussein. But then we turned on Saddam Hussein, and in the the early 90s, 1990, 1991, we invaded Saddam Hussein's country, and eventually took Saddam Hussein out of power in the time following the 9/11 in 2001, we decided that we need to establish a standing military occupational force in the Middle East, which expanded to Afghanistan. And we've spent billions and billions and billions of dollars supporting standing armies of our own and also armies that we put in place or supported being put in place in these countries to primarily defend our interests. So where's all this money coming from? Well, it came from debt that we incurred. And now this president is talking about sending more troops to Afghanistan, expanding our military role, and putting us in more debt. But at the same time, he says that he wants to balance the budget. So he's looking for ways to take money from Peter, as they say, to pay Paul. And, of course, who are going to be the victims or who is going to suffer as a result of this movement to build up our military forces? And he has already told us in so many words who it's going to be. It's going to be the poor white people who really had favored him because they didn't know that he was not for them. And, of course, it's also going to be, in large part, the African-American people, because he knows that we did not vote for him. He knows that we didn't want to be having him as the president. So consequently, he's not indebted to us. And so his idea is, if he's going to have to find a basket to take the money from to support expanding the war in Afghanistan or whatever his plan might be, we are the most likely people that he's going to actually suffer or have to suffer of. So what we want to talk about tonight, but we haven't had any callers come on yet to discuss this, we would invite you to call 657-383-0671. And we invite you to call in and participate in our discussion this evening, because what we are talking about is how we can develop a strategy, or what strategies we can develop to be able to survive these cuts. We don't want to see our young people that are coming out of high school this year and next year and the following years not have the opportunities that have been available to many of us in the past, to be able to go to school and to find financing from federal government sources, as many of us were able to find. But yet, it looks like this may be the case. So if it is the case, what are we going to do? How are we going to relate? How are we going to deal with it? And I would like to have your opinions. I have some opinions of my own. But one thing that I do believe for sure is that we no longer should feel that we have to be so dependent on the federal government or other programs, which I call poverty programs, to be able to take care of our educational requirements. We have to find other ways to take care of our own needs without being virtual wards of the federal government, which we have been in many ways for the last 100 and some years after
the end of slavery, we became wards of the federal government. We were called contraband of war, which meant that the government actually took possession of us. They didn't call us slaves, but we weren't citizens at that point in time. We didn't become citizens until after the war was over in 1865, and then later when the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments were passed. We became citizens when the 14th Amendment was passed, and we were given the right to vote when the 15th Amendment was passed. So we depended on the government to enforce our rights, and they sent soldiers to the South. The government sent soldiers to the South to enforce our rights, but then the political winds changed, and Rutherford B. Hayes, in order to bring the South back into the fold, so to speak, ended Reconstruction, the soldiers out of the South, and then the Ku Klux Klan and the Knights of the White Camellia, the Red Shirts, and other hostile organizations of white supremacists began to intimidate us, to scare us from going to the voting polls, and to do all kinds of what I would say demonic things to us, to put fear in us, so that we would lose the voice of citizenship that we had recently gained. But then years passed and we suffered greatly through the remainder of the 1800s and even up through the middle of the 1900s. We had a situation, for an example, where a young man, Emmett Till, back around 1955, was horrendously murdered, horrendously mutilated and murdered, simply because he supposedly had made a flirtatious comment. A white lady, young white girl, who was the wife of a store owner, or the wife of the brother of a store owner, white man, where Emmett Till had gone to buy some candy, and the lady was in there, and he said something flirtatious to the woman, and it cost him his life. The federal government got involved later, but those people that killed him were not convicted of any crime. The feeling of the white juries in those days was that Black people did not have any rights, including the right to life, that white people were bound to respect. So when Black people were the victims of white hatred and violence and even murder, inevitably the white perpetrator of these things was going to be let off scot-free. And this is what happened. Now, the truth of the matter is that that's happened not just in that case, but in many, many, many cases. Some that made the news and some that didn't. But the fact is that we as a people have depended upon the federal government to be our protectors and also to be our financiers for the things that we need. But the truth of the matter is that we have to grow up. We're going to have to come out of this, what I would say, dependency mode, and be able to stand on our own two feet. So if you would like to contribute your thoughts, if you're listening via the internet, we certainly invite you to call in 657-383-0671. That's the number to call, and we would like to hear your opinion. Do you feel that African Americans should continue forever to be wards of the federal government and dependent upon the federal government, even to the point of providing funds for our students to be able to get an education in the colleges and even in the public educational system? Or do you feel that it's time for us to stand up and become more self-sufficient? Please call in. The number to call is 657-383-0671. We are waiting for your
calls. Okay, and in the meantime, we do want to share something with you. This is something that a very, very popular and significant African-American leader shared with us. His name was Wallace Muhammad. He was the son of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And he wrote a book back in the 1990s. Actually, the publication date was actually earlier than that, 1986. And it's titled "The An African American Genesis." Genesis, of course, means beginning. And in this book, he says, "We are happy to see better days in America and the world. Of course, those better days seem like they're being threatened now because of certain things that are happening today in America and the world." But in 1986, he had an optimistic outlook, and he said, "We are happy to see better days in America and the world. And yet we are not going to be so foolish or naive as to overlook the subtle oppression." And in some cases today, it's not subtle anymore. It's very overt, out in the open, the gunning down of black youth by police forces, for example. "So yet we're not going to be so foolish or naive as to overlook the subtle oppression and serious ills that still work to undermine the freedom of the common person. For example, it is not entirely the fault of the African American community that we are spending our wealth on quick self-destructive pleasures, such as drugs, a shallow image, silly fads, silly hairdos, silly dress styles, and other destructive things." And I'm going to have to add to this, and I know that some of the ladies out there that may be listening via the internet will probably take issue with me, maybe get angry with me, but I'm going to just face up to that and say, and fake hair styling trends, very seldom today do you see our women that are not wearing somebody else's hair, because the idea that's been promoted by the media, by movies, by television, in the popular culture, music videos, is that you have to have straight hair that looks like you are Indian, East Indian, with a African-American face in order to be considered beautiful. And that's the reason why the Korean hair shops are making millions of dollars selling hair that they have imported from India, Indian women's hair, for African-American women to thread into their own hair and so they can look like somebody other than people from Africa. But Imam W.D. Muhammad said it's not entirely the fault of the African-American community that we are spending our wealth on a shallow image. Shallow image, that's a shallow image that our women are presenting. Shallow means it has no real depth because it's not real. That's not their hair. They don't have that kind of hair. God did not have that kind of hair spring out of their scalp. And so they are attaching this hair to their heads, but it's not who they are. It's a shallow image. And then he says other destructive things, the music, the hip-hop, gangster rap music that demeans our women. And, of course,
when you demean the young teen, 18, 17, 16, 20-year-old women, you're demeaning the women of our community in general, because you are also, without realizing it, those who are doing it are demeaning the grandmothers in our community, the mothers in our community, the aunts in our community, people who work hard and suffer to try to keep our community going, to keep some unity and cohesion in our families and in our community, like these gangster rappers, by calling the young women all these derogatory names. I won't repeat them. They are demeaning all of our women, and not just the black women, but really they're demeaning women universally. And the sad thing about it, and the ironic thing about it, is you know how the white people copy the popular culture of the black people. For example, now many of you may not be old enough to remember the Elvis Presley era, which lasted for about 10 years, about 1956 up until 1966 or so, when the Beatles came and took over the popular culture, and then other groups that had that English music style. But Elvis Presley actually got his musical styling from the black people by going to places where he would be able to sit around black musicians down in the Delta of Mississippi, and places like Tupelo, Mississippi, where he grew up in that general vicinity. And he loved that music, and so he imported that black music into the white popular culture. And so you had black people who really, and I'm not trying to deride or put down white people, but they didn't have the rhythmic, what I would say, intuitive talent to be able to dance to that kind of music. They weren't brought up dancing to that, you know, bebop type of ragtime music, or the music that had that syncopated beat. They were used to dancing to 1-2-1-2-1-2 or 1-2-3-1-2-3. So their whole experience in terms of dancing had to be adapted or rechannel or retooled. They finally, after 40 years, seemed to have been able to get it right, but it was hard on them, but they tried. It was something to watch them trying, because Elvis was an attractive person, and his music appealed to something inside of them. A lot of the elders of the white community called that Negro music. They didn't say Negro, they said nigger music, and they called it monkey music and jungle music, and they didn't want the young people to be listening to it, but the young people liked it because they liked Elvis, and plus the music, it brought out something inside of them that was dumb, and it brought out an excitement, and it brought out a kind of a desire to jump and move and shake and do things that they had not had the experience in their culture of really doing. And it was sometimes kind of sad to see them shaking their heads because they hadn't learned how to move their spine and pelvis and do the rest of it. They're getting around to it now, but still they tried. I used to watch them on TV back in the 50s, and I would say to myself, boy, these folks still can't dance, but they've gotten along pretty well over the years. They began to get it down, and now you can see them coming along. But the fact of it is, it all came out of them trying to adapt the popular culture of the black people, and now they even want to become in tune or part of the gangster rap culture. I've actually had the experience of seeing, driving down the street, young white folks in their cars with the windows open, with their heads bobbing and they're shaking and jumping, bouncing up on the seat, listening to gangster rap music by black artists. And now you have white people that are making millions of dollars, some of them making even more money than some of the more popular black artists, singing that gangster rap music. But see, when they're doing it, they're getting into that same stream of disrespecting women. So now they're not only disrespecting the black women, which the music originally was disrespecting black women, but now they're disrespecting the white women, and it's spreading. So these are the kinds of things that Imam Wallace D. Muhammad is talking about when he is talking about some of these self-destructive things. And but Imam Muhammad said it's not entirely our fault that we're using our resources on these temporary and passing things. And it's not, but then we can't just dismiss our own responsibility because of the fact that we bought into our own self-destruction. And we have bought into our dependency mode of thinking that we can't go to college unless the government is carrying us on its back, giving us the loans that we have become accustomed to be able to get the college education that many of us have to have today in order to get decent jobs, at least to get the kind of jobs where we don't do the old style farm labor or manual labor that our grandparents and great-grandparents and many of our parents did. But Imam Muhammad said that something took place in the 60s and the 70s that robbed us of the spirit of the innocent and noble motives of the struggle against oppression that motivated us back in the olden days. We began to have the government give us all of these different types of support systems that took the strong struggle motivation out of us, and we wanted everything to come to us easily. So we're going to close now in a few minutes. Hopefully those of you who were listening that did not call in, we'll repeat this topic next week. Hopefully you'll call in and you'll have some ideas of, you know, what can we do to get on our own feet. There was a saying that I recall hearing quite a lot when I was a younger person. It was attributed to my great-grandfather, but I never read any of his writings where he said this. But there was a saying, we need to bring ourselves up by our own bootstraps. The fact of it is, we really do need to start doing more for ourselves as a community, as a people, and also as individual families, because many of our families do, but many of our families don't save money for our young people to be able to go to college, so they don't incur the gigantic loads of student loan debt. I was fortunate to talk to a very close friend of mine last week, and we were talking about his new baby that's now a year old, just about to be a year old. And he was telling me that when the baby was not even born yet, when his wife was carrying the baby, they set aside money. They began to set aside money in a college savings plan so that when this child got to be ready to go to college at age 16, 17, or 18, because there are young people who are very smart and they go to college at 16 years old. My mother went to college when she was 16, graduated at 19. But that may not be usual, but it does happen. But the fact is, by 17 or 18, that child is going to hopefully have the money to be able to take to the registrar's office and pay her fees without mom and dad or the student, the young lady, having to borrow money. So this is just one of the strategies. It's something that many of our people have gotten so comfortable with in terms of not having to save money that they don't even think about the fact it's really not the federal government's responsibility to be putting money in our students' hands to pay for tuition. It's our responsibility to do that. But we will have to make sacrifices. There are things that we're going to have to be willing to go without. It's very possible that this particular family, that they might not buy a new car the next time that the new cars come out that they would have bought if they didn't have a child to send to college. It may be possible that the house may not get the new furniture as time goes by that the wife would like to refurnish the house with. They maybe might be able to do it, but they might not be able to do it. And the reason why they might not be able to do it because they have a high priority goal that's so important to them that they are willing to sacrifice these other luxuries that they don't really need, but they would be nice to have. But the child needs that education, and they know that. So they may very well go without a lot of things to make sure that they don't have that child carrying a load of debt when she graduates from college, or that they won't have a lot of debt on them because they've signed, they've co-signed for these student loans. So that's just one area that we can focus on. Another area that we can focus on is our churches. You know, the strongest institution in our African-American society is the black church, the African-American church. And our churches give a lot of money to be able to have new, beautiful edifices, buildings, beautiful sanctuaries, mega church sanctuaries, or beautiful robes for the choirs, or even to bring in entertainers. I call them, I'm not going to say it because I don't want to make it sound like that. I don't like their music. They have beautiful bands and beautiful groups that sing beautiful music, but they get paid. And many of the churches put in their monthly budget that they are going to take part of the income, which mostly comes in tithes and offerings and collections, and they are going to set it aside so they can bring in these professional gospel singing groups to make the people have a feel-good experience during the church service, where they probably have enough talent within the church community, as they have had always in the past, because our people, for the most part, can really sing, especially that gospel music. But our people are being actually, in a sense, put to sleep in terms of our responsibility to encourage our young people to do the quality performances in the church that they used to do, because the churches are bringing these professional people to do the singing. In many cases, I've been to churches and I've seen some groups that actually outsang people that are on the records and on the radio. And these people may not have ever put out a record, but they are very popular in that church world, these singing groups, professional gospel singing groups. So I'm saying that some of that money could be put aside for scholarships for our worthy children. And also, the preacher doesn't have to get a Mercedes every year, or Cadillac Excalibur every year, or Sedan DeVille every year, or whatever the style is popular among the preachers might be. And it's moving in the direction now. A lot of these preachers, they want to drive a Bentley. They want to drive a $200,000 car just because they want people to know that they have been successful at keeping the people of the church voting them to keep renewing the contract for the preacher to stay in the pulpit there at that church. And so that Bentley or that very, very expensive Mercedes is a symbol to the world that, look, I've got these people, and these people have got me, and I'm their leader, and this is how they're showing that they want me to stay. But that money that's being spent on the payments for that Bentley, the $1,000 a month that's being spent on the payments on that Bentley or that Mercedes-Benz or whatever, could be going into a scholarship fund to help a worthy student go to college, so that student would not be having to incur college loan debt. So these are just a couple of ideas that I'm putting out there for us to think about. And there are many other things that can be done I'm going to leave with this thought. Where there's a will, there's a way. So no matter what the Trump administration does that pulls back on support for our educational needs as a community of African-American people, we can still get our children educated. Some of our children may have to do what people did back in my mother's time and Booker T. Washington's time. They may have to work a year and save money, live at home, or find a way that they can live with other students that are doing the same thing to keep the expenses down, renting a place that is not necessarily what we would call a fabulous apartment, but just some place that's warm and where they can be able to be safe and work and save money and go back to college and do that every year. Maybe it might take them 8 years to graduate from college, but if they stick with it, they'll have that degree at the end of the day, as they say, and they won't have to be going and getting all of these loans. So there are lots of ways that we can strategize and come up with ideas to be able to deal with the situation of the, what I would say, cut back on the support from the federal government for our people. Well, it's about that time. We've certainly enjoyed sharing these ideas with you all who have been listening. And we hope that next week we will have more call in and have more contribute their ideas to this conversation. But this is Marshall Washington Cabinets Bowie, your host, and this is Booker T. Washington Speaks, our weekly Saturday night family discussion. And we certainly invite all of you to call in and let us, as a family, discuss serious things that we need to talk about and work together to try to resolve to help our community. Thank you and good night. God bless you. And we will be hopefully hearing from some of you on next week. Have a good remainder of the weekend. And this is Booker T. Washington Speaks, Family Discussion Room, signing off.